Welcome to a special edition of the Power Talk interview series. I have not interviewed anyone twice, but there was a gentleman who has powerfully influenced my ideas and become a very good friend. In fact, years ago, I wrote a book called Unlimited Power. As soon as I was done, I thought my next book has got to be on finances. And I came up with a title, Unlimited Wealth. One day I walk into a bookstore and there's my title on the shelf. So I called my agent and I said, hey, I can't even believe this. I found this guy who's got this book called Unlimited Wealth and he just took my title. And she said, I represent him. So I said, well, I got to meet this man. I hadn't even read the book yet. When I started reading the book, I couldn't believe it. It was absolutely the most powerful book I'd ever read on understanding the economy, understanding what makes the world tick financially that I'd ever come across. And since that time, I had the first interview with you, Paul, on Power Talk, and became one of the most popular Power Talks. And so now we're back again to catch up, see what's going on, and I'm thrilled to have you here, my friend, and welcome back.
Thank you. You came to my office, and I'm here in your office, and it's great to be here.
That's great. Tell me something. What has happened to you since we did that first Power Talk? What's occurred in your life? What's changed?
It's funny how everyone else asks me that, and I have to say Tony Robbins in every sentence when I answer it, so I guess I can tell you. When I met you, I was a best-selling book author, professor at New York University, where I still am, and sort of an academic. The big speech I did the year before you was for the White House, for the Department of Transportation one day, to a lot of other academic and government types. And that was the universe I operated in, very happy and very successful, and felt I had reached the pinnacle of, in my profession, a professor and a writer, what might be called success. You widened my horizon in a great way, or your tape widened it, because that tape came out and the phone started ringing. And it started ringing from very, very interesting people. And when I got them on the phone, each one had a compelling story of how their life was turned around and how they met Tony. And then I finally get to, well, that's great that Tony Robbins done all these great things, so why are you calling me? Oh, we want you to be the keynote speaker at our meeting for 10,000 people next month. We want you to do this. We want you to do this. I finally got to the point where I said maximum 4 events a month.
Right.
And I try to do one a week because I'm interested in where I'm going, not telling people about where I've been.
Right.
And last year, I was the keynote speaker for 46 major events before a little over 500,000 people.
Wow.
And that was all from you. I've got a whole staff of people now booking me and doing my work. Of course, I'm excited to do that, but as I say, that's where I've been. I'm more interested in taking the other 6 days a week and working on where I'm going. But I owe all of that to you. And what you've really done for me is so widen my horizons, because I wrote for an academic audience. In a sense, I wrote and produced my work for an intellectual group that knew so many things. What you did is kept telling me how many people are out there, or you introduced me to a whole universe of people so hungry for knowledge and, for my end, so appreciative. And now I focus all my work on less than 2 or 3 syllable words, shorter sentences, and I've redone it. In fact, my next book is going to be 73-page chapters.
Wow.
Designed on key points, entirely focused by listening to the people I speak to, listening to the people I meet who are not economists, who are not, quote, financial wizards, who are hungry for knowledge.
People who need to really apply that knowledge.
Absolutely. The people, I used to write for people who wrote it. I always call half my books, I always say, sold to reviewers, looking to criticize it. Now I'm after a whole different market, you might say, and it's so exciting to get the fan mail. Every Monday, I finish my work on Monday in the office, and I open the pile of mail, and I have so much fun, because these are all people with a story of not how I influenced them and they listened and they felt intellectually stimulated, but how they applied it, how they're going to apply it, how their children are going to apply it, and it's so much more exciting.
Well, I'm excited to hear that. I mean, as you know, profound knowledge is what I think you share with people. And if profound knowledge is really going to be useful, it has to be an idea or a strategy or a distinction that somebody can understand quickly and immediately apply to increase the quality of their life or somebody they care about. And I think what you've really done now is you've really gotten excellent at taking complex issues and making them simple. So let's talk a little bit about where we are financially. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today is I know you've got some great ideas about things like healthcare, the educational system, some of the paradigm shifts that are happening in the idea of what we can do to create savings in this nation. Why are we at 1 and 2% and 3% rates of return for some people? Why is interest rates as low? Why are they as low as they are currently? So we're going to touch on some of those, but why don't you just give us a picture right now? Where do you think we are economically as a nation? Where do you think we're going? And how do we compare to other times in history? Let's say the 1950s, the quote, good old days. Where are we?
I don't mean to give you two answers at once, like the two-handed economist I talked about in the last interview with
right.
you. And yet, that's really how I have to answer it. We are at a point in our economy where in total economic output and growth, and I said it was going up 2 years ago, it's gone up much, much more.
That's true.
The growth I thought we would see has far exceeded my expectations. But we are also at a serious economic crisis in a way, and I really call it an economic/political crisis in terms of who's getting the benefits of that growth.
Right.
What we're seeing is a bifurcation in our economy of proportions that I always have been writing about, but you know how you don't believe it, and I always use words that try to express things, and people say a little too exaggerated, perhaps? Well, I underestimated the bifurcation of our economy in terms of certain people getting wealthier and wealthier and wealthier, and certain people getting poorer and poorer.
And that's in spite of government policy to try and balance that out to the in the opposite direction.
Absolutely, because the government's dealing after the fact. They're thinking, after someone makes all this money and after someone doesn't, I'm going to redistribute it. As opposed to getting right in front of that train and saying, how can I help the people not making it make it? They still don't understand taxation, and all the government policies are designed after the problem has occurred. And they need to take a much more holistic approach. And the danger I see, in, as we'll discuss now, is how fewer and fewer people are what I call jumping on my alchemic train to success by applying new technology and new methods and displacing more and more and more. And this bifurcation leads up to what Joseph Schumpeter, my favorite economist in history, wrote about in Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. Schumpeter, who was the first economist to explain how technology causes economic growth, as opposed to economic growth causes technological growth.
Right, exactly.
And Schumpeter wrote his last book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. Odd book for an economist. And in that book, in the 1940s, he told Americans, don't worry about Eastern Europe and communism. They will all democratically vote in capitalism by 1980. Wrong only by a decade. But he also wrote in that book that the Western countries would vote in socialism or communist policies in their economies for decline. Why? Schumpeter explained that when technology advances, certain people in a capitalist society, due to competition, get richer and richer and richer because they adopt the new methods faster. But they also do the work of the people that the new technological methods displace. And what Schumpeter said is we could reach a day where almost 20% of our population
is unemployed.
Is unemployed, or 50% is unemployed, yet the total economic output doesn't decline because the people causing the unemployment through the machines and new technology are making their wealth of their wages. Mm-hmm. He said when this happens, that's why it was called capitalism, socialism, and democracy, the people vote in communist and socialist policies that kill the goose that laid the golden egg, new technological
growth. So we throw a pendulum from one end to the other, basically.
Absolutely. And he said we could never learn from this. He said you'd have 40 years of socialism in his day in the 1940s in Eastern Europe. Then they would democratically vote out the socialist communists and go rabidly capitalist. Then after 40 years of capitalism, the technology would cause the economy to advance. The majority of people would be displaced due to technology. They would think it's politics and, quote, government, as opposed to technology, not understanding mm-hmm. what was happening to them. Mm-hmm. And even if they weren't displaced, they'd have a friend or a family member who wasn't doing well. Then they'd vote in socialism. And he said it was a 40-year cycle with no way out. I believe he was wrong about that point.
About the no way out point.
Exactly. I believe when you educate people to what's happening, that it's not government policy or something that's causing their son not to get a job, is their son is working on yesterday's technology or some method that's clearly going away. All of a sudden, they see it. Then they don't, even when they're unemployed, democratically vote in policies that kill new advance and new technological growth. So really, the mission I've sort of gotten on since we met is to keep explaining this to people. And it's so wonderful to then keep hearing from them back in letters how they specifically applied it. And I don't really tell people what business to go into. I don't tell them what industry. But they have the knowledge from the things they've done all their life to go apply and realize what's happening.
Well, let's describe very clearly, because not everyone maybe have listened to the first Power Talk. Let's describe here a little bit of the difference of what technology really does then. Well, you know, the metaphors that we've used, I think, in the past is describing, you know, the dishwasher who is making so much per hour and the dishwashing machine displaces that person. And now we've got more productivity. The economy is still getting the benefit, as you just said. But this person is now displaced. And our original conversation was, well, now this guy is loose to go out and produce more value. But, of course, the question is, will he really do that or will he feel defeated? Will he go into what we call learned helplessness? And now, as a result, not do anything, just become a tax burden per se, and worse, not have a sense of a compelling future. Describe to us, what's the difference between quality of life, first of all, now and then the 50s, as an example, because that's what everybody says the good old days are, and what's the real paradigm shift? Let's put it in simple terms for people.
Well, first, the quality of life is so massively improved in just the last 2.5 years we've first did our tape, let alone the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years since the 50s. The quality of life doesn't show on economic indices because the index is for dollars, for example. Right. They say that so many people can't afford a new home. New home today is an average 2,100 square feet. And they can't say in 1960 so many people could. Well, in 1960, the new home was 800 square feet.
Right.
A lot of people can afford an 800 square feet home today without air conditioning, without dishwashers, right, and without all those nice appliances that make the new home worth having without a new kitchen. But they don't talk about that. They talk about brand new home construction, 2,100 square feet, and compare it to the 800-square-foot home.
So we're not comparing apples to apples.
Exactly. Or automobiles. Or any single item you will find, every year you wait till the annual model change because you know it's more for your money. It's either lower price or same price, better quality, which is the same as lower price. It's so endemic to our society, we don't even think about it. We just know it gets better every year, but the dollars don't pick it up. And a major problem here is the money indices that we use to say how the economy is going are effectively worthless for the average person who's considered about how much quality time does he get to spend with his children, how much square feet of space does he get to play with them, what is the quality of his car. Remember when people were late? It was because their car always broke down. I wonder if they had a breakdown. I wonder if they had a flat. Today, cars go 60,000 miles on tires versus 10,000, and they don't break down. And you trade it in because it's something you want so much better. The car you trade in runs exactly as it did when you bought it brand new.
So the problem is we're not measuring real value in the increase of life. We're only measuring the dollars themselves, which really vary radically today. Because what we're getting is more value per dollar.
Unbelievably. And we keep adding to that basket of goods and services we call necessities. Mm-hmm. As Galbraith said, in the affluent society, there is no distinction between necessaries and luxuries. Personal computer industry. There's a reason Bill Gates is the richest man in the United States today. The PC industry, just hardware and software, last year was $150 billion, three times the sales of the auto industry. The auto industry is 80 years old. The PC industry is just 10 years old and has only 15% household penetration.
That's amazing.
Dealing with enormous growth in industries, but of course, you grew up in Detroit. What recession in 91? Recession came in 1981 and never went away. If you're in Seattle, or you're in Salt Lake, or you're in a town that produces software, you can't believe the kind of growth you're seeing everywhere.
Now, what are some of the things that have increased in value massively in the last 2.5 years? You've mentioned some. What are some others? I'm just kind of...
I really have to say the list what hasn't increased in value. Hmm. Food prices have declined substantially.
Right.
We are seeing a massive deflation. What we're seeing is every single product and service since 1990 has declined in price in real terms. Either prices have held constant and they give you more for your money in terms of better quality or bigger quantity, or prices have actually fallen on virtually every single item you can think of in the last few years, including real estate, including rental prices.
So what's creating this deflation? What's actually creating it?
What's creating it is new technology. Every year, the company producing a product almost across the board can produce the product cheaper. But they know that Americans don't want cheaper because they associate lower price with lower quality.
Right.
So each year on most products, rather than lower the price like they do on basic commodities, they give you more in a bigger package or more quality for the same price. Because they know if they lower the price, which is really what they're doing, you think something's wrong with it.
Interesting. So what really creates wealth today? We've talked about this in the past. Let's make sure everybody is clear. It's not owning the resources anymore that does it. You can't just own the land. You can't just own the oil. What really creates wealth
today? To quote my friend Tony Robbins now, as I do so much, it's the ability to add value.
Right.
And you add value by innovating and implementing new technological methods, which can be nothing more than a better way to drive to work versus the way you drive is a new technological method. You have to add value. Those who add value are getting very, very rich because those are the ones leading the price declines we see in virtually every product and service.
So right now, when we talk about money, we're seeing these huge changes in the way people perceive the value of goods and services and also the way we evaluate money itself. What is money today?
Great question. The reason I say it's a great question is I'm almost there, but I'm not there. In 1986, I started writing Other People's Money. And I wrote a whole chapter on the money supply. And every time I wrote a sentence or paragraph, I realized I don't know the answer. It's one of these things you sit down, and right. Every time you put it on paper, you go, I don't know this yet. I worked half the time I spent on the book. I worked on the chapter in money in 86 and 87 and 88, and I threw out the chapter saying it's not ready. I did the same thing writing Unlimited Wealth. I worked on my chapter on money. I still didn't get there and pulled the chapter entirely out of the book. I'm doing it again right now. As you know, I'm finishing my third book, and I have this great chapter on money, and this time I'm going to try to complete the chapter on money, but I don't
promise.
Well,
give us some insight as to where you are, at least up until now. What is money today? Does it have any value?
You already answered it. It really doesn't have value. The reason we see interest rates of 2 and 3%, and I believe on the way to declining more, is that money as a store of value has almost no value. And here's why it becomes so obvious when you realize this. In a traditional model of the economy, let's take John Maynard Keynes, he always said the plant has a 30-year life. And when interest rates are 5% and the return on investment from building the new plant is 6%, you build the plant.
Right.
When the plant would only yield 4% interest rates are 5%, you don't build it. And that's why he said government control of interest rates, which is what we founded our whole modern, quote, government economy or financial business or Federal Reserve is based on, that government control of interest rates could stimulate new production by raising and lowering the interest rate when the plant had a fixed return over 30 years of 5 or 6%. Today, virtually everything you see in business has a 1 or 2 year payback. I'm serious. You buy a new computer for your business, you launch a new product, and you talk to me about some of the things you're doing. They have a 12-month return of capital. Not return on capital, a return of capital. If virtually
so to clarify for everybody, so we're using the right language, we're going so fast for them. For the average person, if you're spending X on a computer, $10,000, you're not going to get a return on that. You're going to get your whole $10,000 back in...
First year. Now, when it goes for first year, so what do? You plan to spend it. Then you run out for a few months to talk to the money people. Then you try to raise the money to buy the computer. When you're all done, ready to close the deal, the computer's made you more than the $10,000 it cost. And now you got to pay the supplier.
And part of why that's happened is that same computer at one time with less power cost you $250,000.
Exactly. And the return of what it does in your business. We're going to talk a little about the tool business. The tool business is the largest business in America today. I'm going to talk about the tool business and the tool function of the economy. What we're seeing is most of what you want to buy to start a new business are tools. And when you buy those tools, they have a less than 1 year return on their cost, meaning they pay back their full cost, principal, interest, everything.
So give me some examples. Fax machines, computers, telephones.
Fax machines, computers, more important, new innovations in factories. You go out and buy a machine. You've got 30 people working on a lathe. You go out and buy a machine that does the same work with 5 people. The first year, the savings pays back more in the cost of the machine. What does all this mean? It means the companies that are adopting new technology, and here I use General Electric as one of the big ones. It's usually most smaller companies that adopt new technology the fastest, though. They become instant cash flow machines. They generate more money, and they become the biggest lender in the world, GE Capital, by lending out their excess cash. Why? Because the things they're investing in by adopting new technology first pay back in less than a year.
So this cash cow, and now they're loaning their money to people that want to go and buy cars.
But it even comes to startups. When you go to start a new business today, if you're adding value, and by adding value, you're supplying a customer with something that they didn't get before, your value add to that customer has less than a 1 year payback. And that means that when you go to start your business, you can talk to your customers or your suppliers, get them to float you a few months, and virtually start new business. I meet person after person who tells me, well, I went out, Paul, and I heard your tapes, and I decided to do my new business. And I started doing it, and then I couldn't raise any money, and the bank wouldn't lend me any money. And I said, so what happened? Well, I don't know what happened, but in 6 months, I was getting so much money from doing it that I self-financed my own growth. So what you find is that people who are free and don't need a salary to pay their family expenses, who can go 6 months to a year, more than likely today actually start their own business and self-finance it, because virtually all the companies in America, large and small, are self-financing today because the new technology they adopt has a less than 1 year payback. Plus, of course, they can rent things they couldn't rent before. You had to build a factory. Today, you can rent a factory. Right. You had to go build suppliers. And today, in a virtual economy, you can go out and find people to do all these things. You would have had to tool up a massive capital investment. And that's a big factor. So what we see is that in an economy where we have an annual type budget, we just decide that 12 months is a return on investment. We define things in annual terms. We bookkeep on an annual basis. Where most new technological innovations have less than a 1 year return, there effectively is no need for capital or investment because what you're doing generates more cash before it comes due to someone.
So that's changing the structure of business, and it's changing who can get in business today. That's what the virtual corporation is all about. I remember in our first interview, I think the concept of, you know, quit your job before you're fired. Tell me what that really means today, and let's talk a little bit about what people can do to take control of their economic destiny in many cases by starting their own business.
People have, in a job or career, accumulated knowledge, and I define this as functional knowledge. There's two types of knowledge in a human being. Generic knowledge, their ability to read, to calculate, to cognitively reason.
Right.
And then functional knowledge. I worked making chairs, I worked making light bulbs, or I know all about the bedspread industry, or some area they've worked in all their life.
So they got a niche there.
Absolutely. And it takes years to accumulate functional knowledge, and in that I include the contacts of the people they know in their business or industry.
Okay.
What we're seeing today is people, more often than not, who are working for a large company, can actually take their functional knowledge, combined with their generic knowledge, go to their employer, and I call it quit before you're fired. And in quit before you're fired, you go to your employer and say, you know what, you pay me and the 30 people I manage, and our payroll is $1.5 million. Yeah. I think I have this third-party company that wants to do it all for $1 million, but I don't want to tell you because you'll fire me. Really? And you say that there's a third-party company that's brand new, using brand new computers that your big organization doesn't want to buy you yet, and they'll do for $1 million what your, quote, work group does for $1.5 million for the large company you work. After you've convinced your boss that they should look at this $1 million company, at some point you let them know there is no third-party company, it's you, wanting to quit before you're fired. Take with you the employees, you've lined them all up, and you'll contract right now to do for $1 million what your big company spends $1.5 million for.
That's nice. That's nice. So in terms of our economy as a whole, what is the virtual corporation then? I mean, I understand taking that on, but what is a virtual corporation today?
The better way of explaining it probably is start with an example of Heinz ketchup. Heinz ketchup used to have these large factories making ketchup, and they had sand come in literally where they made glass. Mm-hmm. They took glass bottles. In one area, they mixed ketchup. Another area, they printed labels, and they made bottle caps. And all that came together in an assembly line, and they shipped out ketchup. No longer. Today, I'm told they have, just on the bottle cap suppliers, 28 suppliers. And if you've seen a bottle of Heinz ketchup recently, remember you used to drop a bottle of ketchup, or you used to have that icky bottle with the top and the metal and the ketchup was in it, you had to shake it? Today, they're crystal clear plastic. The ketchup bottle can unscrew, or it can pop off. You can squeeze it. Right. It's a terrific product. Why?
Stanley Mason, by the way, who's one of our instructors at Mastery, created that bottle. He's the inventor of it, but go ahead.
Take that ketchup bottle. Today, Heinz has 28 suppliers of just the bottle cap. When you have 28 different suppliers, they all compete. So they're all walking in every week saying, I got this better way of bottle caps. Give me more of the orders. Right. I have somebody else, another 20 people might be making the bottle. Another 30 people might be printing the label. And they're all competing. They're all running out to the tool makers to say, give me better tools to make better ketchup labels so Heinz will buy more. Heinz effectively is what we would call then a virtual company. It's just sitting there with a bunch of paper in an office, no plants anymore, scheduling hundreds and hundreds of different suppliers. And always, as Schumpeter would say, getting the most innovation due to the creative destruction of the old method, meaning someone's always coming in with a better method,
right?
Because they're all competing for the business. And Heinz is becoming what we may call a virtual company. No plants, no warehouses. It rents out what they want.
All the more reason why they don't need additional capital. All the more reason why they have more net profitability, and they keep adding more value to the society.
Totally. The more they grow, the more capital they generate.
That's amazing.
And this isn't just for Heinz. This is for every single business. This sprang from the personal computer business in only 1981 and 82, which is already three times the size of the U.S. auto industry.
Wow.
Because the PC business is virtually thousands upon thousands of small suppliers all working. There's no company that makes computers. They all farm out little pieces, and they're always buying the best hard drive or the best components to make their computer the best. And that is the model, I think, we'll see for the entire economy in the future. What this also says, though, is if you look at the PC business, and these guys all get together at a meeting called Comdex once or twice a year, mm-hmm. where 60 or 80,000 PC makers get together, but they don't say, I work for Dell, or I work for Compaq, I work for IBM. I know hard drives. I know code on software. I do ROM chips. That's right. How they define their function.
Right.
What we're seeing from a labor standpoint in the virtual economy is that we're going to return, I really hope so, to the original concept of a union. Unions were the real responsible people for the economic growth of the world from about the 15th, 16th century till the 19th century. Until unions became what we now call them as political organizations, they were entirely people with like technology, cobblers, millers,
right.
Smiths, and they got together and said, let's share our technology and teach each other. When you hired a union person and the work wasn't good, you called the union. They were so embarrassed, they did it again for free, and they sent someone right out, early construction unions. Mm-hmm. They took tremendous pride in the work they did. They were the repositories of technological knowledge, and they shared it with each other. You have to deal with the concept of the word management. The word management isn't what you think of in your company. You train people and you hire people. You don't manage them. Then why do we call it management? Here's why. Until 1900, in the entire world, the job of a businessman was to manage. All you did was say, we're going to make steel, or we're going to make cars, whatever you were going to make, and you hired skilled professionals. Their last name even told you what they did, Smith, Miller, etc.
Right.
You called in the skilled professional, and you said, do this, do this, do this. I'm the manager, not the trainer. Andrew Carnegie and others, in the late 1800s, invented what we now call scientific management. Scientific management, as described by Frederick Taylor, is the process of teaching the worker a better method, as opposed to just hiring a worker who already knows the better method. Fred Taylor and other scientific managers in America invented scientific management. They had no choice. All these immigrants were coming over who were unskilled. There was no skilled labor in the United States, so they had to organize them in teams and train them to do and implement the better methods. In fact, Andrew Carnegie, who was really the best in the world at doing this, he had a policy called scrap and build. He would have a steel plant, and every year or 2 years, I'm serious, he would walk in with an army of goons and level the entire plant to ashes. He said, don't innovate, level it, and rebuild it. He could see this because he had so many plants, and he was the first one in history. He would have a plant in Pittsburgh and a plant in Philadelphia, and he said, why is the Pittsburgh plant producing three times the steel? When he got into it, he'd find it's 5 years newer. And he says, I don't understand what to do, but I know it's better to scrap and build. And that was the name of his policy.
Wow.
So Andrew Carnegie brought us this massive technological innovation. And more important, Andrew Carnegie and his successors like Fred Taylor brought us the concept of scientific management, an American innovation. We will train people into what to do as opposed to hire existing laborers. And of course, when you train someone in the newest technological method, as Andrew Carnegie knew, they're 3 or 4 times more productive. Now, the unions, who were originally the repositories of knowledge, and the union white label, I'm terrified saying this in California, it's a terrible story. The union white label was invented in 1869, and it meant that these goods were not touched by anything but white Caucasian hands.
Oh my gosh.
The union saw all these workers coming over, be they Italian, be they Jewish, be they black, be they Chinese, and the unions were hysterical because they were getting displaced. Why were they getting displaced? Because the new worker using the new technological method was 3 or 4 times more productive. So the unions became political organizations trying to stop immigration and organized themselves along political lines saying we want more money for duration as opposed to before we want more money for innovation.
Productivity, or yes, I understand.
Once that happened and the unions became political, they became the obstructionists to new technological growth. Now, the reason this story is so important is I believe we're going back, thank God, to the past. We're going back to the concept where the union is like Comdex. It's all the people who get together voluntarily, no coercion, saying, I'm a hard drive man, I'm a sloppy, floppy disk man, I do monitors. We're going to all get together and we're going to work and share knowledge so we can leave Comdex and apply this knowledge back in our field and be better for our companies. But my loyalty is not to the company I work for. My loyalty is to my children. My loyalty is to my family. My loyalty is to my own saving. We're turning to a concept where people will take responsibility for their own education as adults and technological innovation and not say, the company won't buy me the new computer. You hear that all the time. That's why I use the old one. I'm going, why don't you buy it yourself and learn? Because that company's going to fire you one day. You'll be dead. And you hear all the time people waiting for someone else to tell them how to improve.
Well, let's go back to Heinz for a second. You know, Heinz now is more productive. All of a sudden, Heinz doesn't employ as many people. Those people are displaced. As you said, if they're not prepared for it, in their whole life they're making these bottle caps, they're in deep trouble. But this displaced worker, this is why we have to be so powerfully motivated ourselves to educate ourselves, to train ourselves. What is the number of jobs or careers a person's going to have today? I think I heard a quote from you on that. Why do they have to train themselves? And what do we do so we don't have this split in our economy? Because all of a sudden, Heinz and Heinz stockholders are making more and more money, but necessarily the people who used to work there are not. What do we do?
The classic dishwasher example, just to paraphrase what we talked about last time, is what's happening all across America. Say I have 3 dishwashers in my restaurant. They all make $10,000 a year, total $30,000. I lease a new dishwasher, a tool, for $1,000 a year, firing $30,000 in labor. I'm $29,000 richer. What are they going to do? We have a totally unlimited, and that's what's accelerated, more unlimited demand for the work those dishwashers are going to do. Why? Because when I fire them, I've got $29,000 more money, or my stockholders do, or someone does in my company, plus the guy who supplied me the dishwasher's got $1,000. And I immediately want to spend that and buy a new product or service. The problem is that the dishwasher is still running around with his resume. A resume tells you what you were doing in the past. It's only useful when you can say, and this is what I can do in the future.
Right.
The problem is what you did in the past was wash dishes, and they don't need dishwashers, or they don't need whatever you did making vinyl records.
Or carburetors.
Or carburetors or all the other examples we've talked about, because those jobs have gone away. What we need is you to use those skills and apply them to something new in our society, and that's where the government society just puts up a wall. It stops the person from getting the new technology and learning the better method. Now, when I first say this, people are going to go, Paul,
wait a second. When you say the government puts up a wall, how do they put up a wall?
They put up a wall because they're still trying to keep the person from being fired in the first place, with all types of employment policies designed to keep the employer from being able to lay him off and adopt the new method and buy the dishwasher. The government sees the problem that I bought the leased dishwasher and fired the people and wants to stop me from firing the people, as opposed to the government saying, wow, Paul, you can do the work of 3 with a $1,000 dishwasher. Let me help you, and let's share that savings, maybe in some taxation, to get those 3 dishwashers producing something new. Mm-hmm. The reason is the government doesn't understand that we have unlimited jobs for those people producing something new. And here's the best example. If we were having this interview in 1960, 40% of America worked in manufacturing. And you said, Paul, what's going to happen to labor in 20 years? And I said, well, half the jobs in manufacturing, the biggest employer of America in 1960, 40%, half of them are going away in 20 years. First of all, you think I'm a nut to tell you, which is exactly what happened.
And if you believed you, you'd be in utter fear.
That half of the people working in manufacturing, bread and butter America, were going to lose their jobs. Exactly what happened. But let's say you accepted it. You'd say, Paul, 1960, what are those tens of millions of Americans going to do? I'd say, oh, they're going in the restaurant business. Well, in 1960, you would have laughed at me hysterically. You'd say, Paul, this is 1960. 5% of the meals in America were eaten out of the home in 1960.
In fact, I'm not a millionaire, I think was the phrase.
Absolutely. Millionaires went out to eat in 1960. Remember 1960? We're going out to eat. What do you want to do tonight, kids? We want to go out to eat. What do you think we are, millionaires? But let's say in 1960, I said to you, 20% of the population, let's think about this a moment, was going into the food service business. You'd say, how could they do it? Well, I tell you that by 1980, 20 years later, 50% of the meals would be eaten out of the home. Think of that increase from 5% of the meals eaten out of the home in 1960 to 50% of the meals eaten out of the home in 1980, 20 years. You'd say, Paul, that's ridiculous. 1,000% increase in unit demand, let alone a doubling of the population, 2,000% increase of a mature industry like restaurants. You'd say, Paul, it couldn't happen. Why? Let's examine. First, Paul, no one's going to go out to eat because they don't have the time to go out to eat, you tell me in 1960. They have to work. They don't have 3 hours for a French lunch. Oh, I would have told you in 1960, we're going to have something called fast food. You would have started laughing. We're going to define restaurants not by the quality of the food or the content, by the speed. And you would have said, that's ridiculous. But let's say you accepted we could have fast food. You'd say, Paul, we can't afford it. Going out to a French restaurant, very expensive. I say, oh, no, we're going to have thousands of restaurants that are going to apply new technology and produce food cheaper than you can get it in the supermarket, which is exactly what it is today. It's cheaper to go to a restaurant, as anyone knows, versus going to a supermarket and buying all these things you don't need for a meal and preparing it yourself. Then you wouldn't believe it, exactly what happened. Then if you kept saying, even if it is so cheap, Paul, and even if it's fast food, people don't want to eat out that much. It's boring. There's only French and food. I said, no, 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 I would have said 1960. There's unlimited food because we're going to have so many different types of food. We're going to have food from countries that aren't even countries yet by 1980, that are going to be in every corner in America, always implementing new menus, and it's one of the most exciting things in your life. And then if you were in real estate, you would have said, okay, Paul, suppose I accept 1960, that we're going to increase unit demand for restaurants 1,000%. People will go out to eat 50% in 1980 of their meals versus 5%. Suppose I accept that there's going to be fast food, ha-ha, that's unlimited fast and doesn't take time. Suppose I accept it's going to be so cheap that anyone can afford it and at any socioeconomic level.
And that everybody's going to absolutely want it.
Right? And suppose I accept that there'll be thousands of countries, type varieties of food that anyone can have it. You're still wrong. I would have said, why? I'm in real estate, you would have told me in 1960, and I know that there are not enough restaurant seats in every city in America. And I would have said, oh, no, what do you mean? There's not enough retail. There's no space. I'd say, let me tell you what we're going to do in 1960. By 1980, we're going to demolish many, many homes, maybe even yours, level the neighborhood, and build shopping centers all around our residential neighborhoods and fill them with restaurants. Again, you would have thought that was ridiculous because there was no place. You couldn't drive everyone downtown to eat, which is where you had to go in 1960. What you see in just the restaurant example, and I can run through it for almost every industry, is restaurants today employ 20% of the population of the United States, up from effectively zero or 2% or 1% in 1960. Going out to eat is one of the most enjoyable things we do with all that extra money we have in our economy. The economists can't index it because they don't add that to a lifestyle index. That's a huge value add. The key question, what will be the biggest industry? I'll answer that in a moment, but first I want to say that by definition...
You gotta keep us in suspense.
The reason is, by definition, before I answer it, I should be wrong on it. It's never obvious. The real beauty of the economy is that it always works and it's always there, and it's not predictable. The key element here is faith. When you understand how it works, you have absolute faith that there will be jobs for these people. Now I'll answer it. And this is Paul's guess. As an economist, I won't tell you this will be it. I believe the largest business in America will be education of adults.
Ta-da, I'm in the right business.
Absolutely. If you think about it, we spend today $330 billion a year in the United States on primary and secondary education versus $50 billion U.S. auto industry. Mm-hmm. That's just for children. Except we spend that under the concept that you will be trained for a job. What do you ask Johnny or Jane today? What do you want to be when you grow up? Mm-hmm. We spend it thinking that you will get a job or career, learn something, and then apply it the rest of your life. Well, today the median career length is down to 6 years. That means 50% of the people in America change careers, not jobs, whole careers every 6 years or more, ranging from 1.5 years for people in food service, because that's an entry-level job for a young person, to 25 years for barbers, who seem to stay as they accumulate customers as barbers almost forever. So 50% of the people change careers. The problem is that 50% or more go to school till they're 18 or 22 or 25, and then where are they going to get re-educated? So what we're going to see is one day our government will say, I want to educate the 40-year-old who wants to learn a new skill just as much as I want to educate his 16-year-old son.
Because there's an economic incentive to do
so. Totally, because A, it's good for the government, and B, I get rich doing that. Mm-hmm. And one day in the government realizes its real role is to educate all people, or we, I don't like to say the government, us, we, as Americans, realize that what we can do best is educate people throughout their entire life. One day a week, since I was 24 years old, I have taught. I have never missed a class at New York University in 14 years there now. And I teach one day a week, and I'm convinced that's going to be the norm. Everybody's going to get out of school and spend one day a week in some type of education, teaching, learning, doing something of an academic nature. We're going to see, effectively, by the way, I believe the biggest business in America today is education of adults, but you don't see it because it's wrapped up in something we call management. You go into any company and isolate their functions of production, shipping, advertising, the largest amount of money is spent training people to use new technology that comes in every 6 months or every year.
One of the challenges, though, is if you teach people how to use new technology as, let's say, a computer program, but you don't really teach them how to learn, or you don't really teach them how to apply their communication skills, then when that technology becomes defunct in a year, 2 years, or 3 years, then you have to train them all over again, as opposed to teaching somebody how to become self-educated. If, you know, I'm all parents probably listening are saying, well, what do I guide my children to learn to do? What should they focus on? Where should they go?
Great. One of the chapters in the new book is called What Your Son or Daughter Should Study in College. Most people think their children in college or even before should study something to do, but I can show them that the thing they study how to do will become functionally
antiquated,
or technologically
sure.
obsolete. And the teachers who teach it in school are by definition teaching the old method because they're not out there practicing and applying it.
Right.
What they should try to do with their children is give what I call the gift of the magi or wise men. The gift of the magi is teaching your children how to improve their ability to learn new things.
Mm-hmm.
The way you teach and improve the ability to learn new things is entirely confidence. You know, some people say to me, my son, oh, he does bad in school. What's he interested in? Oh, he's interested in sports. He's interested in some rock group. He's interested in, you know, camping. I go, great.
He has no trouble learning anything in that area.
Exactly. And I said, instead of fighting it, get him into camping. Start buying books on camping. Start buying books with information he wants. And guess what? He'll be reading the books. Start finding ways that his teachers can channel essays and projects and works in camping or sports or anything he's interested in. What you find is the goal of an education, in my opinion, is to inspire confidence in his child or student's ability to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Once they have mastered camping, where everyone turns to them at the dinner table, you know how you have a 16-year-old sometimes who's a whiz in something,
right.
And everyone turns to him in computers or some area and says, well, tell us. And he's expected to know and he's looked up to.
All of a sudden, he has a new identity. He's somebody special.
Exactly.
He's important. He's significant.
Then he gets into high school or college, and he never thinks, I can't learn anything, because your job then as a parent or educator is keep reminding him how little he knew about that subject when he was 12, when he was 14, when he was 18, when he was 20, and now everyone's turning to him. The goal of a college education, I always say, is by the time you're graduating as a senior, there's one subject that you talk to your professors as peers, but you remember when you were a freshman and couldn't even, you know, pronounce the words that you're now rambling on and doing new technology, new innovation. Then you can go into anything, because you've overcome your fear of learning new things. So inspiring confidence in one's ability to learn is effectively giving someone the ability to learn new things.
In order to do that, you really have to change the core belief of so many people. Because so many people say, well, I can't do that. And you say, why not? They go, well, because I don't know anything about it.
Right.
You know, that's the common thing that people bring up.
And you have to find something that they are interested in, are motivated to,
right.
Which they don't even know they're getting, they have fear of it because they just like it.
Right.
And then make them realize how much they've learned. And that's the gift of the magi that every parent should hope that my child have confidence in their ability to learn new things. Then whatever the new thing is, they can go into any job and go, you know how to do this? Absolutely not. Why are you here? Because I know I can learn it faster than anyone else. Everyone has what I always call the Cousin Betty. And Cousin Betty, you know, first she was a teacher for 5 years, then she sold insurance for 6 years, now she's in real estate. What's wrong with Cousin Betty?
Yeah, now you used to look down her nose at
right.
her. Now she's the norm.
Exactly, but now Cousin Betty is to the employer, oh, so you did this 5 years, and you did this six, and you did this 7 years. Cousin Betty has demonstrated her ability to learn new things quickly, which is exactly what an employer is looking for, as opposed to I did one thing 25 years. That's the person the employer is scared to hire.
That's right. Now, did you answer my question, what is money?
Well, money, as a concept, I believe is going away. And the reason it's going away first is that money, as a concept or a unit of store value, almost has no value. It only has value because you can, quote, lend it to someone to build a factory with a 30-year return. Today, as we discussed earlier, when that factory has a less than 1 year or 2 or 3 year return, that money has almost no value. And what you see is so people store up money and they get less and less at interest rates because there's less and less demand for it. We have, quote, virtually we're heading towards lower and lower and lower lending demand. The banks are all worried that no one's borrowing money anymore. Yet GNP keeps going up every year. When you index it for deflation, we have massive economic growth each year when you index it with the deflation
mm-hmm.
we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, what's going on? There's no borrowing. Well, there's no borrowing because, as we discussed, the companies are generating their own supply of money or their own internal capital. And what this means is that money is something you would accumulate and say, I'm rich, doesn't have much value other than your value to go spend on things you want. It doesn't have much investment value, and that's why interest rates are so low. We're also reaching an area where it's so funny to me, we have the Federal Reserve today thinks they control the money supply. They control M1, the cash money supply.
Do me a favor. Explain for the average person, what is the Federal Reserve? Most people think it's a federal agency, which of course it's not. Okay. And what is M1, and how does it affect the day-to-day experience of most Americans?
Well, the Federal Reserve was formed at the beginning of this century for two functions. One function was to control the supply of money. Think of money in an economy. A person gets out of school and earns $20,000 a year they didn't earn before. Well, that person's going to need pocket cash, right? Working money, $500, $200 to go pay their rent and pay their expenses. And they'll demand money, which will cause the existing money to have inflation or deflation. And the Federal Reserve's job is we'll go then print more money in circulation to match it so money stays at a relative value level.
So in other words, as more people get in the economy, generate value, and are paid for it, we want to make sure that the relative value of that dollar stays the same.
Right, and the way to do that is to print more or contract it when more people lose their jobs. And that's how the Federal Reserve function was. Let's control the money supply. Secondarily, the Federal Reserve got involved after Keynes in the 1930s, and I'll control interest rates and level out the swings in the economy, which we'll come back to in a moment, which I don't believe happens anymore. So the original concept of the Fed was to control the money supply, okay? Well, today, there's no, quote, federal money supply. Kid gets out of school, he gets paid. He gets, the day he graduates college, he gets a Visa card, an American Express card, an increase in the money supply. Mm-hmm. That's the money supply to most of us. Mm-hmm. Or he gets a checkbook that he can draw on, negative balance. Then, if the child loses his job, they take it away. That's a contracting of the money supply.
Right.
And you see how the money supply for 90-95% of the population is not money printed by the Federal Reserve or the federal government. So the Federal Reserve today primarily regulates what we would call the cash supply of money, which doesn't affect your life if they move up or down the amount of cash. The Federal Reserve says they regulate lending. They regulate interest rates at the banks through the federal discount window. They regulate how much banks can lend. But you don't borrow from banks. You find that everything you want to do in your business, if you're a really sharp business person today, pays back in less than a year. The economy or money economy is today private. American Express prints traveler's checks. That's money. So does Citibank. So does Visa card. So does MasterCard. And what we see is that the money supply is entirely in private hands. I say thank God. Totally self-regulated. And we're not subject to what they do in Washington to make our business go up or down.
It sounds like you'd be very supportive then of these things, like people even going to like the local fast food now are paying with a little debit card, for example. So there is no money supply actually.
Absolutely. And think of it. I earn money. My employer doesn't pay my money. He puts a ledger in a bank somewhere. There's no cash involved. Then that ledger gets debited when I go to McDonald's and buy food. Exactly. And you see how the government's out has nothing to do with that.
I think it also changes, though, just like credit cards do, what people want to spend on. They might be willing to spend more. I was hearing a study that was done recently at these places like Carl's Jr. where they're doing this, where they say people will buy more because it's kind of like going to Las Vegas. It doesn't feel as real, or going using their credit card. It doesn't feel like they're really spending money.
It feels real at the end of the month when they get the bill.
they
only do that for a month or two. No, but it's the opposite.
But the difference is because it's debited, though,
and
too.
We need people spending more.
Yes.
The problem
that's what stimulates the economy.
It stimulates. That's the whole economy.
That is the economy, exactly.
The whole economy is, we're getting so efficient. 5% of the whole economy today, I believe, produces all the food and shelter at a basic level for every American, or a 1930 level. The whole economy is people earning more money and then saying, I want to buy this for my children. I want a bigger house to raise my family, and I want more free time with them and want to spend it on something. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps the economy growing. The economy danger is that if people get scared hearing all this nonsense that Washington puts out, because each political party is always blaming the other for what's wrong, they could stop spending money on the new things that they've earned and deserve. That would cause the economy to collapse.
Well, let's talk about something that's at least 10% plus of the GNP, and that's on everybody's mind. Let's talk about health care. It's out of control. Every single year, it grows way beyond the normal inflation rate. It doesn't seem to be deflating like the rest of the economy. It's inflating massively. You have some brilliant insights into this. So let's talk about it. What should we really be doing right now? What are we about to do, as you understand it, and what should we be doing in your estimation?
In trying to analyze the whole picture, I like to step back and look at healthcare as a piece of the economy. Do people want healthcare? Yes. Do they want to be healthy? Yes. Do they want to spend money on healthcare if they earn money? Yes. It's clearly something like, do they want good retail stores? Do they want hotel rooms?
Sure.
Do they want cars? And all these things in America seem to work that people want and the private sector or people innovate and deliver. Why not healthcare? In answering that question, I had to go back to 1957. In 1957, the federal marginal income tax rate for what I always call the people with the nets, the people implementing new technology, was 91%.
With tremendous write-offs and capabilities.
But still, if you were an executive working for a company making $135,000, and the boss came in and gave you $10,000, that day you paid $9,100 to the federal government.
Right.
So you said to the boss, that's why executive salaries were also so low then. They said, don't pay me money. well, I got to pay you or you won't stay here.
Give me all these benefits.
Totally. So they went to Washington in the 50s and they lobbied for something that's the sleaziest thing they ever got through. They lobbied for the right for an organization, a company, to pay for health care of an employee or pay for health care of the employee's children without it being taxable to the employee. Think of it. I want to screw all the other workers in America. And I want to get...
Because it was really just for executives in those days.
Exactly. And by the 1950s and 60s, it went to unions and all the way down the ladder. And today, about 50% of the American population or more, the whole upscale population who works for large companies, gets health care. And they're not taxed on the benefit. Exactly. They're ripping off the other 50%. Think of it. Where we sit today in the 90s, a man earning $90,000 a year with four kids working at Texas Instrument gets $10,000 a year in health care, tax-free. Mm-hmm. Which means it's really like $20,000 to him. And a working woman raising three kids, scrubbing floors, earning $15,000 a year, has to go earn $2, pay state and federal income taxes on it, take a dollar, and then pay for a child's health care. Mm-hmm. In effect, we do have government health care in this country, and let's admit it. If you're rich in the upper half of the country, the government pays half your health care bill. It's disgusting. It's unfair. It's horrible. But starting from that premise, before we say let's tax the benefits of everyone getting health care with a major company, let's analyze what it's done to America. What it's done is it's created a system where the only way to efficiently give the money for healthcare before you get to what it'll be spent on is through the employer.
Right.
Because only the employer can get a tax deduction and give you $2 for every dollar. So the employers, what started out as a benefit, is now something that they can't stand. They'd give anything to get out of the healthcare business.
Because it's not their business, and it's the business they're in now.
Totally. And it worked very well when you stayed with the same employer for 25 years. Mm. But now that you switch jobs every 3 or 4 years, the last person you want taking care of your children's healthcare is the employer.
Right.
That's the essence of the problem with why we have so much hysteria about healthcare, because I'm not going to work for them all my life. I want to pay for it myself. So what happened, though, which is even more insidious, is that with the employer paying for it, and paying for it in a lump sum, the consumer has no interest in price. If I tell you there's a great car for $10,000, it's as good as $120, you'll probably test drive it this afternoon. If I tell you you can drive over here to Sam's Wholesale and buy a lot of things a lot cheaper, you'll go there. That's why retailing works. And what you see is in every area of our business where a need is not being filled, let's take Sam Walton. Sam Walton in 1963 was over 40 years old, working all his life for Ben Franklin Stores. And they wouldn't go rural. He noticed the rural stores, the rural people were getting screwed in terms of prices because they were buying from the mom and pops at 2-3 times the price of the inner city large stores. So he quit and started Walmart solely to go into rural areas and sell goods and services at a lower price. In every business we see, Ray Kroc with McDonald's, people want food cheaper, people want food faster. In everyone we know, an individual said, these people want it at a lower price or better quality, I will give it to them, and guess what? I'll make a few billion for myself while delivering them a better product or service. Except one industry, healthcare. Because when these people went into it, and both Sam Walton and the American Association of Retired Persons went into the business of saying, we will give our members, our customers, lower priced health care, both people said no. AARP and Walmart went into discount pharmacy. They found when they had discount pharmacy, people thought there's something wrong with the product.
And they assumed the drug was not as strong or as effective.
Exactly. And today, a good example of that is generic drugs. Generic drugs, most people don't realize, are almost drug for drug much better than the name brand that they replace.
Why?
The reason is that if you have a name brand drug, like, well, a little slower on that, 95% of the drugs taken in America today, prescriptions, are not taken for I have penicillin because I got sick for a week. They're given to someone because that person had an operation, like my mother had a collapse, and she takes Dilantin 3 times a day for the rest of her life. That's a 95% of the drug bill. Those people don't need to be able to go to their pharmacy 24 hours a day and get it in 5 minutes at $28. They need a 3-month supply shipped to them equivalently of $10 or $5 in a big case. But they don't get it. Why? Because when AARP and Walmart went in the business of trying to sell them the drug cheaper, it's not their money, so they wouldn't load up on the supply. But back to why the generic is better.
Let's clarify that for a second. So I don't have a personal investment in saving money because it doesn't make a difference to me personally, so why should I go through it?
Totally.
And if my impression is cheaper is less effective, why should I even consider it?
Totally. And the reason the generic's better is this. In 1975, a drug company makes a drug that you take for ulcers. So you take that drug. You go off, you don't see that doctor anymore, most likely, and you take that same drug for the rest of your life, like my mother taking Dilantin. The problem is that in 1978 and 81 and 85 and 89, the drug company that prescribed the drug in 75, they learn who dies from side effects, they learn about problems with it, and they improve it. They improve the drug every year. Do they give you the new improved version? No way. Because to give you the new improved version, Tony, I have to write you a new prescription. And I have to have you go to a doctor. And when you go to the doctor, now there's competitive drugs for that 1975 drug. I won't take the risk that the doctor will put you on a different competitive item. I won't even tell the pharmacist to tell you when you come in, ask your doctor. The reason is you might shift brands and take now a similar drug from someone else.
And I lose my cash flow over 10 years.
Totally. So what you see is they screw their own customers. The name brand drug companies put a customer on a drug for 20 years. They improve it every year. They don't tell them. Because if they tell them or tell the doctors to go find them and tell them, easy to tell them, they go in the pharmacy, give them it right on the label, saying, ask your doctor, there's a new one. They only do that when they know they're going to get the new one sales because there's no competitive drug.
Now, so what's different with generic? Yeah.
The generic drug is not the newest. It's usually a few years old. Mm-hmm. But it's not 20 years old, which is what most people are taking in their prescriptions. So what we see is generic drugs, just as one example, are better. Last year, we spent $70 billion on prescription drugs, of which $7 billion at most could be replaced with generics. We replace the whole bill. That's $63 billion instant savings. Why don't they do it? Because the customer thinks...
The markup is that much different between generic drugs and regular?
Unbelievably, easily 1 to 10. Although the generic companies play the same game now, too. They raise their prices because people think if it's too cheap...
Right.
It doesn't cost anything to make a drug, Tony. These are made with chemicals that we make out of almost anything. Drugs have virtually no, like software, marginal product cost. The reason, and what do they tell you, by the way?
Research cost me so much, I got to
biggest lie ever. What they forgot to tell you is that in the 1980s, Wall Street took apart the research companies. Wall Street said to almost every business in the 1980s, listen, you're either in business doing business or you're in business research. We don't want to back both. And they have companies like Genentech and high drug companies that only do research. Wall Street says, I'll put money into research. Then there are companies that just produce drugs, existing license patents, and go out and produce lowest cost efficient distributors.
For example, Burroughs Wellcome did not create AZT, from what I understand. They purchased it from somebody else.
Right, because research is now a third-party business. AT&T Labs is a third-party company.
And yet they're charging $10,000 a year for people to take AZT, or is it $5,000?
Great example. And the reason is, research, but they don't spend anything on research. What you see is that the drug companies have this story from 20 years ago, they don't want to fight anymore, that we spend on research. You don't hear that argument anymore, because they know it's not true. They know they spun off their research company somewhere else to a firm, or Wall Street only wanted to invest in a research firm.
Obviously, there are some exceptions. But that is the general rule now, is what you're saying.
So what you see, in essence of this, is that the generic drug is almost more likely a better drug, and we'll go through a lot more examples, drugs are only one, could be replaced for one-tenth the cost or less, and doesn't happen. Why doesn't it happen? Because the customer doesn't care. When's the last time you called a doctor up and said the visit and asked the price? And if you asked the price and he said $100, it was only if you could bring $100 with you. When did you last time say $100? It was $80 last time. When did you call three doctors and shop price? Yet how much do you do that in the supermarket? How much do you do that buying a car and anything else? See, the consumer is always driven for the best value in everything that they pay for. That lets the Sam Waltons, the Ray Crocs, the Bill Gates show up.
Come in and find a way to add more value, make it cheaper, make it better.
Exactly. And think what someone like Gates or Sam Walton or Ray Kroc adds to prices and a value in our economy. It lowers prices to one-tenth their normal cost due to new technology, and everybody can benefit. That hasn't happened in the drug business. It hasn't happened in the medical business, because no one cares about price, because the people who are the decision makers or have money to stock up,
consumer.
Absolutely. The consumer is not oriented towards price of something he or she's not paying for, because a third party's paying for it. How do we get out of this? Here's the way out. First, the government has to say that, and that government is us, remember, we need to tell our leaders, we should either tax everyone a fair value of the income tax on their health benefits or tax no one.
So which do you think we should do?
I think that politically we could never start taxing working people for their health care benefits if they work for a big company, so you should let anyone have a tax deduction.
So it doesn't matter whether you work for a big corporation or not, whatever money you've spent on health care should be deducted personally.
If the company paid for it, you don't get an income like it is now. If you pay for it, you get a deduction. Because
that would make it fair, then it would be balanced.
Of course, and 50% of the people are small business people. You know what it really does? It screws the little guy who wants to quit the company and go in business for himself. I talk to so many people wanting to quit before they're fired, and the biggest problem they have is health care. Let's level the playing field.
This session continues on the next CD.
Now we level the playing field, here's what will happen. The day we say that health care is tax deductible to everyone, an employer like me with 55 employees would call my employees in a room. And I'd say, everybody here, I don't know if you know this, but I pay $5,000 a year for your health care. I don't care if you earn only $10,000 a year or $12,000 a year here, I pay $5,000 for your health care. Everyone here has a $100 a week raise right now. Wow, $5,000 a year. I'm going to give it to you at Christmas. It's all yours. Great news. Now the bad news. The bad news is you're going to have to pay for your own health care, and you have two choices. You can either take this money and buy it, or we're going to keep our group plan in place, but I'm not administering it now. You elect the administrator as your own group. Right. And on the stage after me will come my insurance person, who will say, if anyone here wants, Mr. Pilsen will deduct the $100 a week from your paycheck, give me the money, and you can have the same health care plan. That's the first step.
And most employers would be thrilled out of their mind because they're out of the business that they're not. Totally. They don't want
to
be in.
You don't tell your employees where to live. You don't tell them what church to go to. You don't tell them what car to buy. You don't tell them what school to send their kids to. Why should you tell them something is private? That's how to get their health care. It never should have been an employer's position. Step two. The moment you do this, my insurance guy comes on stage. Here's what he's going to say. And this will take a little understanding. He says, right now you have a policy that Mr. Pilsen bought for you at $5,000 a year, and you pay... we pay all, or $100 deductible.
Right.
If you would like to raise your deductible to $2,000, he says, let me finish, where you pay the first $2,000, I'll lower your premium by $3,000 a year. Think what he's saying. You now pay $5,000 a year premium for a no-deductible policy.
Right.
I will charge you only $2,000 a year.
That means $3,000 now is in your pocket.
Totally. And if you want, Mr. Pilsen will still withhold $100 a week and give you $3,000 at Christmas. Pretty good. So you have a $3,000 check at Christmas. If you don't think you'll have it.
And probably a good move for most people.
And you pay the first $2,000 of health care, or if you need a transition period, Mr. Pilsen will let you draw in advance on that $3,000 out of the first two. Just, you know, we don't care. It's your money anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, when they think of it, would say, yeah, I'll take the policy that I pay the first $2,000 of health care for my family. If I get $3,000 savings, why not?
Yeah, the first year you've paid for it.
Totally. You get $1,000 profit guaranteed, especially mm-hmm. if I, as an employer, are willing to hand them the money as they need it if they spend the first $2,000. Why will this happen? The reason it'll happen, Tony, is that when you go out and spend on healthcare, and this is microeconomic analysis, not macro, the first $2,000 you spend costs the insurer $4,000. Do you see why?
Because of all the paperwork and trying to process, especially on small items.
You're
like
only
that.
Spending $20, $30, $50 everywhere, and I got to mop up after you. And in fact, none of that paperwork is computerized. You know why?
Why?
Because it's deliberate. The insurance companies, in my mind, have several billion, tens of billion in float to the hospitals. The hospital did the work and owes the money.
So if it was processed that fast, they'd have to pay out fast.
The last thing insurance company wants to do, they fired the MAS guy quick who comes in and says, let's build a computer system to get claims in here faster. Get rid of him. I'm serious. They do this. They say,
you're going to mess with my liquidity here.
That's right. The hospitals want to put the systems in for the claims, and the hospitals
sure.
aren't putting in any new technology because they're small individual hospitals. So what happens is the first $2,000 of health care for a person costs $4,000
just for administration. Right.
So you see how the insurance company makes a guaranteed $1,000 by right. lowering their premium $3,000. Now, that'll be step one.
Which is a win-win-win-win. It's a win for the
Absolutely.
Employer, a win for the insurance company, and a win for the consumer.
Right. Now think what happens. What happens is when you're paying the first $2,000 of your health care, maybe you will stock up on that drug your mother needs, you know, in 3-month quantities at 1/10 the price. Maybe you'll read the article a little more about generics, or you'll call a doctor and say, I saw this drug for half the price. I'll call the doctor, not I'll wait for him. Could I buy that for my mother? Is it as good? And he'll say, yeah, it's a later formula. She's on an old name brand. Maybe you'll start getting interested. The day you start getting interested, you know who the next Bill Gates will be or the next Sam Walton? It'll be health care. It'll be the best and brightest minds we have in America who say, I want to be rich. I want to make billions. What do you want to do? I want to help deliver health care affordably
More
to
for
lots
less.
Of Americans.
That's right.
Totally.
Right.
And you'll see the next billionaires of our society delivering health care. You don't know any billionaires in health care, do you? You don't know any people who have made money delivering what people want, health care, to tens of millions of Americans who couldn't afford it. We don't know what this business would grow to because we've never tried.
So we basically have this giant wound in our society because we aren't using free market, you know, approaches to this particular industry like we do in every other industry.
Absolutely. And it's been going on for so long that they talk about how should the employer provide health care, not should the employer provide health care.
Right.
It's so insidious. And it's a complete paradigm shift. It's like all the forest. They're talking about how should the employer pay, not realizing there aren't going to be no employers. Everyone's going to be self-employed, like the computer industry, Comdex people, working as a specialist in their small work group. There won't be a big company to pay for their health care. And what we need to do is get the government out of the business. This is such a classic case of a problem that never would have existed if the government didn't get involved back in the 50s by allowing a tax deduction for health care only if you worked for a big company.
Well, the other thing that it does is you see a tremendous amount of people that do not want to have permanent workers, small businesses. They want to have temporary workers so they don't have to provide health care because it's such a big expense for them.
Totally. And there's no place for those people to go and get health care because the insurance companies, everyone's focused on the big business.
Right.
It's as if the federal government got together with your big Fortune 500 employer and your Fortune 500 employer said, my people don't have future with me. I'm not implementing technology and I don't want to teach them new computers and they want to quit. Help me keep them from being fired. Okay, we'll really screw them. We'll charge them double for healthcare if they quit. Ha ha. Can you picture it? It's as if the federal government got together with the Fortune 500 companies to conspire to keep you in that job.
Well, and the worst part is if we now start charging employers even more and putting even burden on the employer, then we're going to see an increase in the prices of what they do, or you're going to see employers say, I don't need as many employees.
Which all comes down to what we talked about, killing the goose that lays the golden egg.
Right.
What we're doing as a society is we're trying to kill the new technological innovation for the employer as opposed to help them innovate and help them grow.
Let's talk about some other symptoms in the society that are going to create some paradigm shifts. And the word is overused, but massive change in the rules. One of those I know that's happening in various parts of the country, I know where you're coming from, is happening in the area of how we're distributing funds for the education of our children. Since education is the essence of how people are going to learn to become more valuable and add more value, and probably the biggest disparity that you're talking about is not just that technology has entered the world and now I can get something cheaper, is that that dishwasher does not have, he's not on the right side of the technological curve. He's not educated. Brawn is worth a lot less today than it ever was before. Brains are worth more and more. The people with the brains are the people that are getting all the money now. So the point of the matter is now we got an educational system that is so far behind the current society, it's a joke. And we have a tremendous disparity. The quality of schooling that my kids get in a public school is better than most private schools because everyone lives in that area, very wealthy.
With the federal government paying half of all rich kids like your kids' education.
Right. That's right. So let's talk about what's happening because that is changing now. There's been a big change in the state of Texas, for example.
And it's a bigger change than you're even dealing with in education. Most people have a significant part of their financial wealth or liability today with a mortgage on their home.
That's true.
They don't realize that the biggest factor affecting the different single-family homes in American suburban communities is their school system. There's this massive shift coming that's running through every state, and they don't even know it's happening. In essence, here's what's happening. You move to a nice neighborhood to send your kids to this wonderful public school. And what you're really saying is, even though I'm rich, I want the federal government to pay half my kids' education. Just like in healthcare, as terrible as it may sound, we have federally funded education for rich kids. It's called school tax deduction. You voluntarily leave the city and move to a suburban community, mm-hmm. abandoning the other poor kids who might benefit from meeting your family and kids, because the federal government says that if you send your kids to private school, you can't have a deduction. But if you send them to a school system where you live in an elite community, which might have 1 or 2 acre zoning and doesn't allow poor people to live there, mm-hmm. and you pay for your schools through property taxes, you get 100% federal tax deduction for the property taxes.
In other words, you're writing off your property taxes, and your property taxes are primarily paying for the school system in that
Absolutely.
Community.
Absolutely. When you look at property taxes in the $10,000, $20,000 range on rich houses, mm-hmm. 80, 90% of it or more is going towards the school system. And you raise
that
it every year.
Is that true in most states in
yes.
the Union?
It's true in most, not states, in areas like Scarsdale, New York,
okay.
or La Jolla, California, where people move and voluntarily keep raising their taxes to put more into their school system.
Mm-hmm.
What you're really doing, though, is you're getting a tax deduction for that school system, and it's had such a terrible effect on our society. I can't help it if people say I want to leave the inner city and move to the suburbs because I want a better life for my kids or a better school. But I can help it if I'm the federal government and I'm encouraging that, because the side effect of that in our society is what I call the Kill a Mockingbird syndrome is not happening. In Kill a Mockingbird, the rich girl, Jem, gets to meet the poor Cunningham boy and they pour syrup on his meat and they both learn. The rich girl learns she's rich and needs to help out poor people. The mm-hmm. poor people sees a family where they don't beat the parents, et cetera, et cetera. That used to occur in every single home in America. Every kid you know had some family, unless he came from a rich family, every rich person today, that helped them along. That no longer happens because all the upper-class people move right out to the suburbs. Why do they move out to the suburbs?
But they're not just doing it for their kids, though. I mean, a lot of them are moving up because they love the ocean view or they love the environment or they love the fact that this is a community that has like values or like focus.
Except that the primary reason most of the people I see is that most people are moving. When I talk to, maybe I have too many friends, you know, raising young kids, is I've got to educate them. I need a place with a good school system. Then they look for the things you just mentioned of the nice home, the nice area.
Because, you know, Paul, my experience is I know a lot of people that are in that position are sending their kids to private schools. Because, you know, for example, in New York City.
There's no choice.
Yeah, there is no choice.
But there is. In New York City, you move to Great Neck and you move to Scarsdale and you get a federal tax and state tax deduction for the money you're paying for
your
school.
Do you think that actually motivates most people?
No,
in their
they don't think of it that way.
But that's actually what happens.
That's what the economist does.
Okay, I'll buy that 100%.
The behavior occurs because
right,
they just run the costs. Because when they first move out, they're not that rich.
Right.
They're upper middle class. So what happens is this federal tax reduction for public schools causes a massive shift that the government shouldn't be involved in.
I agree
with that. Pushing people out to suburban communities. When that happens, those kids never mix with poor kids. Well, here's what's happening. What's happening is, and it started really in Texas in 1989, when the Supreme Court of the state of Texas ruled that it is illegal under Texas state law, constitution, to have one school system in Texas, we had one, paying $10,000 a year for kids' education, and another paying $1,800 a year. And Texas invented what in 91 we called the Robin Hood Bill. And the Robin Hood Bill says, we don't care what your school taxes are for your school. We're going to collect everybody's school taxes, and we're going to take from the community where you're paying $10,000 a home and the community where it's $2,000 a home and basically give $5,000 out to every kid.
Every year.
12 states have now passed what we call Robin Hood bills. And again, what that says is that we don't care what school taxes you pay, we're going to confiscate them and give them out to poorer communities. What you're going to see is a massive shift in the value of single-family homes, because many of these homes are in communities that have a great school system, and that's what causes the demand between one town versus the neighboring town, what the school's like. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the schools are going to be equal in terms of dollars. And I believe the Supreme Court of the United States will soon rule on this issue and will rule the way Texas went.
So what will it lead to? Won't this lead to those same families just saying, okay, I'm going to put my kid in private schools if the quality of the education...
That's the sad part, Tony. The sad part is it's sort of like what we did with segregation. Mm-hmm. We said we're going to raise the level of the bottom up, but then all the upper class leave and everybody gets to be the bottom level. Mm-hmm. It's very sad. We mean well. And that's a separate issue because in education, we're not adopting new technology and new tools, which is a whole separate issue. But the first issue people need to understand is they need to look at the home they live in or the community they now live or about to buy a home, and say how much of this is based on the school system. What are the school taxes relative, and what percent of my property taxes goes for schools? Well, let me tell you, there's going to be a big shift coming. You may then want to buy in a neighborhood that has a poor school system, knowing that you're going to get all this money from the rich school systems around. Mm-hmm. Or if you're in a rich neighborhood, you should know that's about to happen in virtually every state. Why? Because it's fair. I think it's fair and wonderful that when a person makes money, they should spend it on their kids' education, the first reason to go make money. But it's unfair for the federal government to subsidize rich families through a deduction of school taxes. It wouldn't be unfair if it was given to everyone, that deduction. But it's not. You pay your school taxes, you get a deduction, and then you live in a community that has zoning laws to keep out all the poor people. That's not fair. They are Americans and deserve equal education. That's the first shift coming in education. The second shift, I'm kind of optimistic because my whole business, since we spoke, my 95% business, is what I call tools for teachers. And I really came to this business as an economist. I saw $330 billion being spent on public primary and secondary education in America versus $50 billion for the auto industry. Meanwhile, the $50 billion of auto sales, there were $4.5 billion spent last year on tools to make the cars better. So the auto industry, only making a few hundred million profits in their worst year on $50 billion in sales, spent $4.5 billion on tools because they know they're out of business without better tools next year. Today, the tool business is the biggest business in America. Hewlett-Packard, IBM, Texas Instruments, and on, with the biggest companies in America now, started as tool makers. In effect, Hewlett-Packard and TI were oil drilling companies. And they hired some engineers to build better seismic equipment.
Yeah.
And they got so good building the seismic equipment to find the oil, they said, let's get out of the oil business and make more money selling what we know, our tools, to other people in the industry. And today you see in the computer business, which is why it grows so fast. You don't see computer people making new software companies. You see users developing software for their use because they're the best ones, they're the closest ones to it. And then they go out and sell that software and become a much bigger business than the business they were in. And they abandon their oil drilling or marketing, whatever business they are, and become a tool maker. Tools today are almost the largest component of every item. You see why. Today, a $100 item has only a dollar or two of raw materials. When you cut it down, there's no oil in it, there's no raw materials, there's no wood. It's made out of plastics or synthetics. It's the tools that make it that cost most of the money.
Right.
And the tools are always declining in price, which is what we really talk about with technology. What this means is that the tool business is now the largest business in almost every industry. The single largest business of the tool makers, the Hewlett-Packards, not the business, except one, public education. We spent $330 billion on education last year, and effectively none on tools, which is unbelievable. So when I started focusing on it, I said, why? And there's another phenomenon happening here. Before there were movies, actors were not rich. Because how rich could an actor get when he could only appear every night?
There's no distribution, right?
Right, before 500 people. Movies let an actor get rich because they distributed. And an actor was good, and then other actors could aspire to be actors and created what today the largest export product in the United States in the 1990s. Every year is our movie, just the rights to license our movies overseas. Mm-hmm. less than 50-year-old industry. Now focus on education. There are teachers out there in every field. I can find one in almost every school system who are so dedicated and so good and have huge value increases to society. They can't get rich. Why can't they get rich?
A, they're saying 30 students or 100 students.
Totally. So the biggest business in public schools will be something that takes the teacher who's learned a subject and distributes it, because every parent I talk to wants better education. Mm-hmm. Every school principal at any school wants more, but there's no one supplying tools. So under the concept of tools for teachers, I've geared up a company we call ZCI Publishing, and we've developed a platform that, in effect, I don't like to use this, but it's the best description. We build Nintendo or video games around a teacher's accumulated knowledge over 30 years teaching freshman English mm-hmm. or pre-calculus. Mm-hmm. So we take a teacher that has some particular expertise. The teacher I want, by the way, has been teaching 30 years, and for 10 years sent kids to detention because they said bog instead of dog. Then in year 11, they learned that the kid had dyslexia, and they spent 20 years identifying dyslexic kids and helping them make up for their first 10.
Right.
That's the teacher I want.
Right, I understand.
And we get that teacher before they retire, or before we got to start all over, and we build a title about what they know best about motivating children to learn. I don't care if it's Civil War, if it's pre-calculus, or it's English. And we build on a CD-ROM an interactive program with lectures, with text, with lots and lots of questions and answers and video games and all types of fun things. All of that teacher's accumulated knowledge. And what's so exciting about that is that we don't have to start over. And initially, that disc is not going to be used, because there's no distribution market now, by parents or kids at home. It'll be used by other teachers. Mm-hmm. So we focused our whole business on technology of tools for teachers. We're doing a program now we can put on a little PC that does the things the teachers want most. You know what they wanted? Attendance. They wanted something with a little picture of each kid on the screen that they could click on and get the kid, where he's from, if his mother doesn't live anymore, and mm-hmm. things they want to know. Mm-hmm. Our substitute teacher could, or an art teacher who has 8 classes. And then they want grading and attendance and just do their work. In every business, someone stood and said, oh, you do this all day? Let me build a computer program to make you 4 times more productive, except one business, the biggest business in America, education.
And healthcare.
So we've geared a whole company called Tools for Teachers under ZCI Publishing, developed this Power CD, which is our trademark name for the platform, to capture everything a teacher knows. And with that, we're giving the teachers other things they want, like attendance and grading and letters to parents. They're all the same, and they're all repetitive tasks. You only had to build this once. And I believe that education for adults will be the largest business in America, because it will carve itself out of corporate America as more people become self-employed mm-hmm. or individually employed, or more corporations turn to the Robbins research-type companies to say, help teach me this, because you do it all the time, and we'll learn from each one.
And they begin to realize that labor is capital. The more return they get from that labor, if they train somebody, mm-hmm. now they get a 3 times return on the amount that they're spending.
Absolutely. What you're seeing is, remember, in 1890, the first ad agency was formed, called Compton Advertising. It was 2 people at Procter & Gamble making Ivory soap commercials, who said, we've learned so much and all these other companies don't know. Let's leave P&G and form an ad agency. There was no ad agency. And we'll share what we learned from client to client. And initially people said, I wouldn't hire you, you'll steal my knowledge. But they realized, yes, you'll steal my knowledge to my competitors, but I'll still get more out of you because you'll share with so many more. What we're going to see is education will become a third party business, as you see what you learn going from corporation to corporation. They share, and you learn, and you get better each time.
Right.
What we're going to see is corporations are going to abandon their function of teaching people and turn to the experts for how to teach them.
Just like the bottle cap manufacturer is going now to 15 different sources, or the best source that's available.
Absolutely. And once public schools, once we give the ability for a teacher to get rich by making a title, what we're going to see is a huge business for both education for children, education for adults, not only being the biggest business in America in terms of sales, be the biggest business in America in terms of tools. And we're gearing up to be the leading toolmaker in the United States for people who teach.
And our CD-ROM of our first interview is the one that was reviewed in all those.
Not only the one of
magazines.
The first interview was the first disc out for the Sony portable CD-ROM player, is the first one out on so many platforms. I can't tell you how proud I am that it wasn't even a disc, Tony. I guess your listeners should know this. I wanted to do this as a concept, and no one believed me. And I visited Sony, and I visited every company, and they said, Paul, you're going to have to build one, a finished product. Well, no one would give me copyrights to hundreds of books and articles and all the things I needed, let alone good audio. You took a gamble and gave me all that to build that first disc, and I'm very, very, very proud that we made history in that, but it isn't made yet, and it's very exciting that I got to do that with you.
Well, and I'm real thankful to the team that we had, my staff here, of Karen and Dina, who really helped mm-hmm. to make that happen. Obviously, if the educational format of the government's involvement in supporting people and the taxation situation change, where people become more associated with their dollars being spent on education, you may see a similar shift as you do in healthcare. So mm-hmm. pretty important. Let's talk about a third primary subject here. What are we going to do now in this country for people to be able to create a sense of certainty about their future. You're saying storing money doesn't give me certainty for the future. People really won't think they want money. What they want is a sense of certainty that in the future they'll have a better quality of life. They won't have to work their entire lives. How are we going to create that for people? And where does savings play a role in that in the future from your perspective?
Well, first, we're not going to necessarily create it in the sense that people are going to have to create it for themselves. And still saving money, especially at a time of deflation, which is what we're seeing, you know, you can make the money. It's pretty good that you can know you're going to take care of your future. The problem is making the money, and that's the third area the government has stopped something natural from happening. It is natural that people would want to save money for their future. It is unnatural that it wouldn't be. So why is savings a problem? Well, here's why. The government got involved in savings, much as they did in healthcare and education, and created a disparity that kept the private sector from doing what it should be doing. The best thing you should see advertised are plans for savings. The problem is that most people today, the bulk of America's wealth, is saved in pension plans. And what that means is instead of your company paying you, and you paying taxes on it of 50% or more, state and federal, and then saving, and then paying taxes on the interest, you can save it tax-free in a pension plan. And as anyone with a calculator can figure out, over 20 years, you can save four or five times the amount with a pension plan that accrues interest tax-free that you could after tax.
Right.
What that really means is that the government is saying, when you quit the big company, say goodbye to retirement, say goodbye to your pension plan, we're going to really get you. It is so insidious that, again, we tell the executive at Texas Instruments, and I don't mean to pick on TI, they're just a big company near where I live, gets $90,000 a year and gets a savings plan paid more than 50% for by the federal government through a tax deduction, his pension plan, and a working mother trying to save for her children earning $20,000 a year, scrubbing floors, has to pay taxes on the money they make, put it in the bank, and then pay taxes on the interest.
She has no way to really save any money or create a future.
In effect, what we're going to see, I hope, is a revolution where people are going to say to the federal government, I don't know if the government should be the provider of service, a more democratic view, or I don't know if the private sector should be Republican view, but the government certainly shouldn't be involved penalizing the people who go off on their own and try to save for their own future. We've got to get to an unlimited IRA type account. I happen to believe that if we have insured deposits, it should be insured deposits above, say, 50 or 100 grand only if you lend it to the federal government. That'll pay off the deficit overnight because people would take their increases in income. I wrote this up in Other People's Money and buy T-bills, which would drive interest rates even lower, but more important, people would lend their own money to the federal government, as opposed to gambling it away with SNLs or banks, which we really don't need more of today. And deposit insurance should be limited in some way. But what we're seeing is that the federal government shouldn't be involved in penalizing people who want to save for the future. And this tax change, like we've talked about in healthcare and education, is coming. Because as people find out, it's the way our government leads today. I used to think I had to go to Congress or be in Senate or do something to, quote, be a leader. And I realize now how wrong I was in thinking that. Today, our leaders, and I don't mean this negatively on any one in particular, they don't have time to lead. They lead like hunting dogs. A hunting dog stands in front of you and marches and is your leader. But if you run the other direction, it looks to see you're no longer following. It runs in front of you and it marches very proud to say, I'm the leader. I'm leading you. And politicians stay the same way. They're always looking at the latest poll or looking over their back to see what people want them to do. Then they do it. They go to Congress thinking they'll have time to teach, to do the things you and I get so much fun doing, teaching people, but they don't have time. They have to get elected, watch what people want to do. The leaders of society are those who go out and teach people new things for the politicians to then go and act. And one of the things I'm so excited about what you've given me the opportunity to do with the exposure you've given my work is to join the pack of leaders, which is really teachers.
I appreciate your compliment, but you certainly, you blazed the trail because of your incredible ability to synthesize information and make it practical. And I, as your friend, I want to keep supporting you and doing that
But it's not just me, Tony. What you do so much with Mastery is you've built such a wonderful distribution organization for your cutting-edge technology. You've then gone out to people like me. There are tens of us that I know of, and there are probably hundreds in this system of Mastery, that now you go out and you find the leader in every field and you distribute that person or give us a platform to reach so many more people than we could ever dream of.
Well, thank you. My goal is compress decades into days, and you've just given us several decades of understanding in a period of about 90 minutes. As we wrap up here, tell me something. What is your feeling about the future right now? And maybe, and you touch on it, we touched before about Japan and what's happening there. Maybe you can give us a little bit of a sense of what you see happening internationally. Are we still going to be a leader in various fields?
Well, first, I hate the concept leader because we tend to look at Japan like we're still at war with them to most people. Those are mothers and children and wonderful families. You and I both spend a lot of time there. And I can't handle this view because I once worked in the White House. It's us and them. The war is over. I love those people, my friends over there. We don't have to fight them. Japan, the United States, and Western Europe and the seven tigers in Eastern Asia and probably a few countries in Eastern Europe are going to, quote, make it. They're going to join the world as we know the Western world and continue unbelievable economic growth. I believe we're going to start applying our technology through some of the understandings we've talked about today to rapidly improving the abilities of our lower classes in America and throughout the world. That's the good news. The bad news is the majority of the world I'm not so optimistic about. And the reason is that in the 60s, the whole concept was that we would adopt new technology and trade our technology to third world countries for their raw materials. We don't need their raw materials now. More significant, the new technology we're evolving today only works. It's new software if someone already has a PC. It's things that if you don't have 110 volts in every house, you can't use all this new technology because you can't plug it in. We don't make tractors that work without a big support system, and on and on. And what we're seeing is that we are not yet applying technology to the four-fifths of the world that doesn't live in the countries I mentioned earlier. And those countries are continuing to fall more and more off the edge while our countries go better and better. If we were starting all over today, we'd do a Peace Corps not to organize wonderful, idealistic young kids to go dig ditches. We'd form a Peace Corps for technology that would tell scientists and engineers, I will pay you to develop technology that has no application in America. Focus on the problems of food in this country. Focus on the problems here. There are other areas, by the way, that could change this. As I wrote about in Unlimited Wealth, we could see things like superconductivity, which is real, it's not cold fusion. Superconductivity is coming, which would let us deliver wastewater treatment and power to third world countries at 1/100th of the cost we had to build an infrastructure for. Right. And that could allow, through technological breakthroughs, these countries to rapidly develop. But right now, you asked about the next decade. The Western world, as we define it, is getting richer and richer and richer. I believe we're going to apply this technology now to our social problems. We should have done it years ago because it was good to do. We're going to do it now because we get richer taking care of our social problems.
We have the incentive.
But the third world, which is really becoming much more than half the world. Remember, it used to be called third world. Today, I would include much more than half the population of the United States. I would include almost 50, more like 75% of the population of the world is today third world, is going the other direction. And we're not helping them or not getting them back on this train. And I call it the alchemic train to success because it's almost so hard to know where to start. They need power before they can implement the new computer. They need roads before they can bring the new car or bring the new tractor.
Well, I had the privilege of meeting Nelson Mandela. And one of the things that he was sharing was that the vast majority of his population, almost 85-90% of the population, lives in an environment with no infrastructure. I mean, no sewers, no running water, no electricity, nothing of anything like that. 48% of them, Paul, cannot find a job. The top 3% of the people who go through the schools can get a job. Only 3% get a job. 97% of the people that go through school can't get a job still. What can we do to make a difference there? I mean, you talk about bifurcation, you know, in the world, and there's bifurcation in this country. How do we turn that around? It feels like out of this whole conversation that technology is going to keep pulling us where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. What can we do to make a difference in that area?
Well, I believe the answer lies in more technology. My whole Tool for Teachers program is we're developing a lot of minority educational products. Because I know when I build a Malcolm X product, I didn't just get a kid to learn Malcolm X. That might have been the first time that kid wanted to go learn how to use a computer.
Right.
So, but that didn't come naturally. Because when I looked at the market for CD-ROMs, and I said, who wants to buy the products? And we're doing a title now on JFK assassination. And they were all upper middle class products, so the ones I could make money in. I had to say, in addition to doing those products, I'm going to go affirmatively out with money that will not pay back right away and build a lot of titles for people who don't have computers so they'll go buy computers if someone will want to get them for them.
Right.
But we need to start applying that on a worldwide basis. We need to start as responsible businessmen, because ultimately it'll make us more money worldwide, as just like we're trying to take care of our social problems in the United States because it's better for us. We need to take care of the problems in the world that we're going to have a refugee problem like we never even dreamed of.
Right, right.
And what we're going to need to see is affirmative action taken on the part of individuals, not affirmative action from a government forcing you to say, hey, I will take a little bit of my time and develop products for people that the market's not there, but will help those people. We're really going to need to see it in the technology of infrastructure development. Up till now, aid in this country that's been paid overseas, I'm sorry to say, has been all political, buying people to not be communist. We went around to certain leaders for the last 30 years, and we said, if you don't vote communist or take money from Russia, we'll give you some money. Now we need to not just hand money to despots, but say, how can we improve the infrastructure of your country, and how can we help you with our scientists develop technology that'll improve your country? Whole new shift in what we think of in terms of foreign aid.
So it sounds like to me that the future is an education period, that each of us has to educate themselves so that we're on the right side of technology and we figure a way to not only do well ourselves, but really then share what we've done with others by finding a way to add more value, to make those resources available to a larger percentage of people. You know, one of the biggest, fastest growing populations in America is people over the age of 65. And people used to think, at 65, I'm going to retire. But as you know, you can look around and what midlife is now in the newspapers and magazines is 50 years old, not 40 exactly. years old. So what do we do with all these people now who are physically, potentially productive, but also very often in very poor economic position? What do we do here?
Well, first of all, they're not so much in poor positions. That's, again, government policy.
Right.
It is obscene that we tell people who are in great shape, you and I have people who can outrun us and kill us with 70 years old.
Right.
And somebody goes into them at 65 and kicks them out by law. It is absolutely obscene. First, we've got to get rid of this government policy that says all people who are old are feeble and
right.
can no longer work.
Right.
But more important,
or teaching people to expect that, for that matter. That affects them as much as, you know, as kicking them out.
30 years ago, you focused on the 45 to 55-year-old market as the market making most of the money, whose kids were now going off to college and had disposable income for your product or service. Today, that market is 65 to 80. Because those people I know, 65 to 80, they don't want to live in old people's homes. And the reason is an 80-year-old person is the same as a 60-year-old person in the 1950s when we used to eat huge quantities of meat and didn't know what we were doing to our bodies and destroyed ourselves. And the population growing up now, when they're 70, will be equivalent of somebody today who's 60.
Well, they're doing all kinds of research now showing 70-year-old men, they put them on a workout-type program with weights, and they become as strong as 25- and 30-year-old men. And we're living in a society now where the baby boomers growing up have lived with these values of always being active and physical, and they've lived with the values of exercise. So that market is going to change. So what do we do?
But from a marketing standpoint, one of the greatest opportunities when I walk into most businesses and they talk about who their customers are, and I go, what are you doing for 65, 70-year-olds? I mean, old people? No, I mean, people who are very well off live in the same home they've lived in. My mother's 79, lives in the same home I grew up in, wouldn't think of leaving there for some area where they group all the old people together. What are you doing to market to that person to make them feel good? The retirement organizations treat them like old, feeble people in retirement homes. That's not what they want to be, and that's not how you're going to live when you take all your money and retire, quote unquote, because
right.
you're probably never going to retire.
Right.
And no one is focusing in terms of housing, in terms of so many businesses, on the person who's 75, 80, but doesn't act 75 and 80, which is going to be all 75 and 80 year olds, when the implications of all the things we're doing with better health and longer lifespan and hopefully soon letting people work till they want to quit working as opposed to the government kicks them out, all kick in. And that's probably one of the greatest business opportunities I see in every firm, to concentrate on 65, 75, 80 year olds who are not necessarily acting their age, and less of them will act their age, or more importantly, there's going to be huge opportunities. For example, like in apartments, they want to live in the exact same house. They just want a nurse to come in once a week or someone to call them. They want all types of services in case to cover the health side, but they still want to live like normal people, and no one offers that from a real estate side. So just real estate alone, the planned retirement community is not what they want to live in. They want to live in the urban lifestyle they always lived in with an extra one or two or three services that allow them to do that till they're ready to pass away.
Well, also, it seems like the educating of these people for the workforce is a very strong possibility. A lot of these people have so many experiences and references that if they were put in someplace other than fast food, which is where you're starting to see them, because a lot of these people are expensive.
No, you know why? That's not why they go in fast food.
Why?
McDonald's. McDonald's couldn't get suburban labor. McDonald's, by the way, is one of my favorite companies because, unlike most American firms, most American companies go out and hire and say, what's out there? Oh, not out there? Well, I can't go to business. McDonald's did this twice. McDonald's went in the inner city in the 70s. And everyone said, you won't be able to make it in the inner city because you won't be able to employ those inner minority kids. They have no values. They don't share. They're not interdependent. There's no white teenagers to work there. What did McDonald's do? It made movies and analyzed the problem that most inner city kids who grew up, say, without a parent or without a father don't know. They think, if I don't go to work today, I don't get paid. That's fair. No one ever taught them that if they don't go to work and turn the lock on the door, the mother or three children who needs the money can't work either. When they taught them that interdependence, they were able to hire inner city youth and think of the benefit to society. McDonald's did it again. In the 1980s, McDonald's moved into the suburbs in Florida and found they couldn't get teenagers to work there, their normal labor force. So what'd they do? They tried to hire old people. Old people couldn't work their cash registers. You know what they did? They built registers with big buttons.
Right.
They built a whole, re-engineered the entire McDonald's around how to employ 70, 75-year-old people who necessarily don't need the money. That's your best employee. Wants to come in, wants to talk to someone, and wants to
interact with people.
They
exactly.
hire managers at 70 years old who grow and become managers in the company of other 75-year-olds who are very excited. You got to walk into McDonald's in certain areas in Florida and really see this. Think of the benefit to society. But here we had an employer who said, I can fit these employees, as opposed to most American companies who just say, ah, let them come in here. I'm not going to do any training for them. And what we're going to see is all of America is going to jump on that bandwagon, focusing on older individuals. And the benefits to all of us are incredible. Think of the lifestyle benefit of somebody 75 years old who wants to work, being able to continue to work.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It creates a compelling future for everybody.
And again, this underlying this is the concept that you need to make people retire at 65 to make room. We don't need to make room. We have jobs for both of them because they both can produce products and services and buy each other, the person below 65 and the person over. But most people are still locked in this philosophy that there's a limited amount of jobs, land, wealth, minerals out
there. The old paradigm, right.
And we've got to let those people get fired to make room for someone else.
As opposed to realizing that as they become part of our economy, the quality of life for everybody increases. And it's not like they all have to work at McDonald's at 75 years old. They can work in executive positions and corporate positions. They can create their own businesses, for that matter. But we have to create that kind of thought process in people at that age. And that won't be difficult to do with more and more baby boomers moving in that direction over the next 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Absolutely.
There's all this information that we're seeing each day about the building of the information superhighways and all these major corporations, these computer companies and telecommunications companies forming these giant partnerships. Tell me, what is your vision? What do you really believe is going to happen out there, and how is it going to really impact the day-to-day consumer?
It's going to impact in a very big way, as my whole theory is based on. The speed at which technology advances is entirely dependent on the speed with which we exchange information. The written word created civilization, because now we could share better farming methods. The printing press created the Industrial Revolution, because now you could not just make a new tool, you could distribute the information. Mm-hmm. And the computer is really the thing responsible for the acceleration of technology now that we see. From a government standpoint, and here I sound very much like a Democrat, I'm really on both sides these days because I can't stand these labels. The government's function, in my opinion, is to do what the private sector can't afford to do. A post office was a great thing to do in 1776. Roads were a terrific thing to do in 1920 when we passed the Highway Act that built all these highways across right. America. And these are the primary things that made America grow ahead of so many other countries. When it comes to an information highway or any type of electronic distribution system of information, if the private sector won't do it because they can't all get together or doesn't have the capital, it is the exact role of government to step in and do it. So I'm very much in favor of government stimulation of the economy when they're doing something the private sector
won't do. They're building an infrastructure for the private economy to be able to take advantage of.
Totally. I've been asked by certain cities and certain mayors, and I've done this now several times, what would be the biggest thing we could do to get going? I said, build a fiber optic network. Because if you connect all your homes with fiber optics and your businesses at first time, you have such a competitive advantage in moving companies into your town. And you're almost the only one who can do it because you're the government. And you have to dig up every road and create that fiber optic network. But don't ever let a private company do it with a monopoly. Don't ever let one company lay in fiber optic cables, for example, and then not allow anybody else in. Yeah. It's got to be open like the roads. And it's the perfect example of where we should tax people and increase taxes to build a government information highway. Or I even think there's a better way is the government designs the specs and controls it and lets private people build it, which would mm-hmm. be obviously the way mm-hmm. I'd like to see it implemented. But the implications are just so, so massive. Because we don't realize like what we're doing with our Tools for Teachers program. You could deliver any type of our programs and all our disk CD-ROMs will play on a server through a fiber optic TV set. We're negotiating now with some cable companies who said, my child has trouble in math. Dial up to a lesson with a famous teacher. Read their background on why this person can teach you pre-calculus. Do it and give an exam all on the television set with a remote control. And that's just the start. You can find out about jobs. Unemployment. You could solve unemployment with such an information highway. And here's why. The biggest factor in unemployment today is not a question of jobs for people. It's finding people. It's locating them. You open up in any city with the worst unemployment in America, the newspaper, and you'll see the largest source of advertising for the newspaper, the classified ads. You go, wait a minute. Unemployment in this town is 10-20%. Look at the classified ads. Why? Have you ever had to try to find someone for a job? Do you see how much work you go through till you find the right person?
Right.
You think it's hard on you, Tony, the employer. Think what it's like for the employee going all across town. What we need are affirmative centers, places that they can know about the jobs that are available. Think what an information highway will do. With an information highway, we can post all the jobs with full video descriptions.
From all over the country,
from all over the country or all over the area. And you can shop for your job on your television set and get unlimited information. You see how easy that is, and that doesn't work on the newspaper because we can't afford to print the paper for it. We can allow every employer to go in, list it, you click on it, and here comes the boss saying, I need to hire a person, here's what I'm looking for, here's what I'm willing to pay, here are the skills. Or you could have unemployed people post their skills and their resumes and scan them electronically. In unemployment today, it's really interesting when you look at unemployment, there's a real estate analogy. In real estate, we talk about 95% full occupancy is occupancy. And I always said, why don't we go for 100%? Well, you can't get 100. And the reason is if you've got a 3-year lease on an apartment that turns over once every 3 years, you're going to be 5% vacant just from the 1 month it takes for someone mm-hmm. to move out, clean mm-hmm. the apartment, and move in. Figure 1 out of 36 months are going to be vacant. So we call 95% full occupancy. In unemployment, we used to call 95% full employment. And the 5% unemployment was the people who changed jobs.
Right.
But this was in the day that we only changed jobs every 25 or 30 years, when you had one job and one career the rest of your life. Today, with the median career length down to 6 years and people changing employers every 2 or 3 years or more frequently, I think full employment's around 80%. But you could raise full employment to 90% if all you did was improve the information flow of people looking for jobs and people wanting to hire. When you want to hire someone, Tony, you want them that day. If they were there, you'd hire them that day.
Right.
Think what an information highway, just one example, will do to the unemployment rate in any city where you implement it.
Also lowers the cost to the employer to find those people in the first place, potentially, as well.
Massive. And then unemployment rate can have just from improving information. So this is where the government is so misleading. The government thinks they need to create more jobs. That's all I hear coming out of the White House. They don't realize what they should be doing is creating an information system that lets people who have jobs and people who want jobs find them.
Right. Once again, dealing with the real cause instead of the source of the problem in the short term.
Absolutely.
Fabulous. Fabulous. So much of what people are deciding to do, or how people feel about our society, or what they can or cannot do, is based upon what they see in other people, but maybe more importantly, what they see in the media. The average person today watches television 7 hours a day still. So if that's the national average and people are getting their information from the media itself, what role are they playing in either accelerating the growth of our society, accelerating the job market, accelerating the education, or decelerating it, or creating an obstruction to it?
Well, first, before I answer that, people who watch TV 7 hours or 7 minutes need to understand the media are businessmen like you and me.
Right.
They're trying to make money. When they run in the newspaper, sunny day tomorrow, go to the beach, you walk by and don't buy the paper. When they write, big storm coming, unemployment, catastrophe.
You got to buy the paper and find out what is that, because it's now a necessity instead.
Now, you see commercials all the time that provide you useful information, but you stand back because you know they're selling you.
Right.
And you take it with a grain of salt and you use that information and you still go out maybe and buy the product, but you don't accept it. Same thing with the news. They get up every morning thinking, how do they sell you to keep you from flicking the channel? That's called bad news. Bad things are going to happen. You don't watch good things, because good things, you just go do them. And as long as you understand that, you don't get mad when the media is constantly hitting you with bad news. Now, the media, unfortunately, or most big businesses today, are so locked into their own systems, they don't understand innovation, and they always fight it. Best example is in Seattle. A company has built an electronic highway for jobs. You can sign on a terminal and say what your jobs are, and all the employers list their jobs, and pay connect time, only the employers pay, employees are free, scan really good information with this thing, you can communicate through it, and get jobs. That would massively lower the unemployment rate in Seattle, and they're doing a terrific job, except they have been prohibited from advertising in the local newspaper, and they've sued the main newspaper in Seattle, because the newspaper,
they see them as competition.
The largest source of revenue to that newspaper are the classified ads for jobs. They charge 6 times per page what they do for regular advertising for classified, because that's their revenue source. They have a monopoly. And they don't want to give up their monopoly even to a better system. Of course, what they should be doing is they should build the electronic highway and advertise in the paper how to use it. What I see across America in almost every field, the leader has so much to lose. And every time they want to innovate, there's always some executive who runs a business saying, don't innovate, because you'll kill it. I saw it with Ziff Davis, PC Magazine. They produced the number one CD-ROM of 1990 called Magazine Rack. It was every magazine published in 1990. You and I have used it.
Yes, exactly.
1992, I wait for my update. It doesn't come. They refund my money. I go and find out that the reason they cut it is that the sales of the CD-ROM, while it was the number one selling CD-ROM in the country, were cannibalizing their online distribution system of information that they sell at $200 an hour, which is an obscene price, and some executive convinced the company to kill the CD-ROM
product. So somebody else will just take it and run with it.
Totally, exactly. The power base in every area, whether it be political ideas or business, always has so much to lose that they focus on what they're going to lose, which is why it creates so much opportunity for the rest of us who have, quote, nothing to lose as we enter new businesses.
What about the side of just the cultural experience? I mean, you know, what a culture is, what creates community is things in common. If we have all these different choices, do you have any concern that all of a sudden people don't have as much shared experience, or where do you think we'll get that shared experience for society?
Interesting. That's why we see such a return to religion right now.
Mm.
And so many people in the exact system, which is already starting to happen, we see people returning to their roots,
yes,
people returning to their traditional values, where they say, I can't comprehend all this, so I want a little rock that I can come home to.
Right.
And even though I don't understand all those religious rituals I was brought up with, I want them back. I always view it as the safety valve. I became fairly religious after my father died when I was 25. And I'm very grateful that I was brought up as an Orthodox Jew and had this to go back to.
Yes.
And the reason was, I look at religion, quote, an intellectual, you know, someone who does well in school, as a safety circuit breaker. I have been given, in a world of most people say having a 256K computer, I have a 257K or something it seems above in my capacity to learn new things. Great. But all of a sudden my father died. And when he was taken from me, I had a choice. I could jump out the window and die because I could not function missing him, or I could return to flick the circuit breaker on, you know, that it just goes off preventing the fire.
Right.
That's what I call religion. Religion is that circuit breaker. You may not ever have to flick it, but it's nice to know it's something to go off when you're given an intellectual problem that has no answer, like the death of a parent or a child, or something so cataclysmic that you don't know where to turn. And that's why we see all around society people building, I call it their circuit breaker, returning to religion. I don't mean to downplay religion. I mean, I have very, very strong beliefs. But as a society or as a scientist, I see an absolute wonderful value. And it lets people have that bedrock to turn to when things crash for them.
Maybe what it really is people learning to turn to an invisible power that's greater than anything that they can see that's visible.
I've spent a lot of time studying the Bible the last few years. And the Bible, I originally started to study as our common set of values. In that, Tony, I might say, someone say, I hear you're friends with Tony Robbins, Paul. How do you feel about Tony? Now, I can sit there and spend 20 minutes describing Tony Robbins and why I like him, or I can go, you know, I guess I love Tony like Jonathan loved David. And if you know the Bible, we can go on from that point. But if you don't, we've got to spend a half an hour.
Right.
What the Bible is for most people is the universal communication language. English or Romance languages were not written for expressing emotion. The Eskimos have 38 words for snow, and we have one word for love.
Right.
English or Romance languages, when coupled with the Bible, which has every possible story, is the ultimate communication vehicle. But today, of course, we teach people English and French, God forbid, and German without even teaching them the Bible so they can't express their feelings, which is why you see two people who love each other in a relationship can't communicate, because we've taken away the common bounds. That's why we see religious people today, be they Muslim, Christian, or Jewish, who have the same values, are able to live on streets and be best friends, even though they're, quote, opposite religions. They're not opposite. They have the same common stories with which to say, I love him like Jonathan loved David.
Well, what's sad is that we have people all over the world who are killing each other over the name of what they call God.
And that's really not the case. When you really look at it, their economics. If you go to Northern Ireland between Protestant and Catholic.
So they're blaming the term of God for it.
Economic issues.
What about in Bosnia?
Bosnia, to me, is economic issues.
Really?
It's economic and political and cultural issues. You know, I spent 5 years traveling through Eastern Europe, almost a third of my year there. And I've always said that when the Russian Empire went, the first thing they'd want to do is kill each other long before they would ever want to build up their economies. It's a terrible thing to say, but in America, you walk in a room with me, Tony, and we see a Chinese kid with a Korean kid with a African-American child with a European with a Jewish kid all playing. We think it's the greatest thing in the world and wish we could all be like that. In almost every other society outside of the United States, they think, oh, it's terrible. Next, they're going to hold hands, and one day they're going to get married, and one day they're going to breed. How terrible. Because what we take for granted, our greatest asset, that we understand and love each other as individuals and don't see the racial differences, took us several decades. It didn't happen fast enough, but it certainly happened real fast in this country. That is the great gift America needs to give to the world, because with education that comes, that has not reached the rest of the world. And most of the world's problems in Eastern Europe will be these countries tearing each other up and killing each other because they've been ruled on the fear of each other, underlying a belief in scarcity. There's only a limited amount around, and if the Muslims get it, or the Croats get it, or the Bosnians get it, we can't get it, as opposed to we can all get it. Today, the richest societies in the world are Singapore, Japan, where the population is so densely packed. And in America, the richest cities are the ones where everyone lives close. We have unlimited land to house and feed and have people have great lifestyles. These people haven't been brought up. And it's that education we need to share. And with that comes the universal concept that only America seems to have regarding races and peoples.
Well, and America obviously can continue to improve in that area as well. But what I hear you saying then is that the ultimate economic resource is cooperation, and therefore maybe the ultimate economic resource is love of one another.
Unbelievable, yeah. You always take it far beyond where I've already gotten it. That's one of the exciting things about sitting with you, but that's very, very true. It's the love that leads the education. Why? Because we love each other, and we'll all be rich if we love one another.
It's funny how Socrates said, learning is remembering. Remembering the most basic truths and really living them seems to create the quality of life that we want. And that quality of life will certainly show up in economics, but it's got to show up in the original source to start with. So caring about one another, seeing each person as equal and someone you can learn and grow from and connect with is maybe the ultimate resource of all.
When you analyze religion and you say for a moment, and excuse me for being so open, you might, let's say, does God exist or does God not exist? If you analyze religion and say, if God exists, and I say, excuse me, go to hell, God, he's not mad. He's God. He's so powerful. I'm the one who hurts when I say something blasphemous like go to hell, God, because it's me. He's not hurt. But if I say go to hell, Tony, he says, hey, wait a minute. I love Tony. Don't you ever mess with Tony. You can mess with me, God would say. Don't mess with Tony. What we're seeing is if there is a true and just God, which I obviously firmly believe, the God would be mainly concerned with how we treat one another, not how we treat him. The only differences between all the religions of the world, and here I put Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Muslim, Jews, is the way in which they treat God. They all have the exact same rules, which is the reason that any religious people can live on the same street. They don't steal, they respect each other's property, and all the commandments. Today, all religions have the same things in how they treat other people. Their only difference is how they treat God. And he loves it. If you're God, I'd love all this variety. I'd love people praying to me on a Friday. God, the Jews praying to me on Saturday.
So your metaphor is like a food court, is what you're
Absolutely.
Trying to tell me.
If you were God, you don't want people keeping Sabbath
oh
all the
gosh,
same day
Paul.
Of the week. You want it 3 days different. And so the only difference between all the religions of the world is how they treat God, because they treat each other the same way, which is why all their children in a country like America can live on the same street and grow up and go to the same school and get along very well.
Hmm. I have to say, Paul, you don't really have the metaphor of thinking outside the 9 dots. I think you think outside the 32 dots. Thank you. We're out of time. We're out of tape. We're going to have to do another conversation sometime in the future. Is there any one last word you want to put in before we cut off here?
No, but underlying all this probably is we live in a world where the most valuable thing you can make, silicon chips today, is made out of sand.
Yeah.
And education is the 99% cost component. Or yeah. value component of every single food product or service we could deal. When we cut through it all, education is the whole area. And that's why we have the unlimited capacity to take care of everyone in the world, because all we need to spread is more intellectual knowledge. And it's not just a line, because when you spread the intellectual knowledge, you can use the resources in your own country to feed, house, and service your entire population.
So ultimately, the bottom line is we have the resources because we live in a world of unlimited wealth, unlimited resources.
Unlimited physical resources when we apply the education. And that's what we need to spread in a worldwide basis.
Yeah. What it really comes down to is making the right kinds of decisions. And as I often say, it's in our moments of decision that our destiny is shaped. The decision to read your book, the decision to come meet you, and the decision for us to become friends has impacted us both in a positive way. And I feel very privileged to count you as a friend, and I appreciate having you here again.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Take good care.